Hello, everyone. How are you? Good day, good evening. No matter where you are, no matter what you're listening to, please, we hope you can join us on this exciting journey of fun and adventure. And we are beyond thrilled to speak to our next guest, Steve. They call him Steve, but he also goes by Opus Science Collective, and we'll find out why as soon as we get started. So I am Mark Chaffardini, the host of the Go See Talk podcast experience. So let's welcome Steve to the show. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, man. Good to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. Have to say, you know, as a journalist, as a blogger, as somebody who runs a film site, you're supposed to temper your fanboy, whatever it is inside, but I just have to let you know I'm a fan. I love your stuff. I'm excited to have you on the show. And it's kind of like, you know, if it wasn't for Bandcamp, my world would not have been turned upside down with your music and all the other vaporwave and synth stuff out there. So let's give you a nice big round of applause. So,
cool, man. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, we were trying to figure out a time to meet, and we're playing the ignorant American doesn't know the time differences, but Steve has a tea, I have a whiskey, so it's 5 o'clock somewhere. The one thing I know about tea is that, to quote Donald Pleasance,
tea without milk is so uncivilized.
How do you take your tea?
I do have milk, but only like a tiny bit. You know, okay. I like it to sort of take the roof of my mouth off a bit. I like it nice and bitter.
So when you're when you get your creative juices flowing, when you need to hit one of the dueling keyboards you have there, do you have some energy drink, a go-to snack? What's your motivation?
No, tea is really. I mean, I used to be a very heavy smoker. I've switched to vape now after sort of being peer pressured by my kid to give it up. But so yeah, normally it's just a vape and a cup of tea. That's all I need really to keep me going.
I feel like there's some tie-in between vaporwave and vaping.
Maybe, yeah. Subconsciously so, definitely.
Well, Steve, let's get to know you. Welcome to the stage. Come up to the podium. Let's tell everybody about what piece of music, what album, what concert got your blood going at a young age and just set you off on this journey.
I mean, wow. Like, I guess as long as I can remember, I've just always been fascinated by music. From a young age, I used to sort of dial into the soundtracks on films and video games. You know, like you know, in like the old games on the Super Nintendo and on the, I get what for you was the Sega Genesis. You could go into the menus and sometimes like preview the music in the menus. I'd gladly just spend ages going into like the menus on Street Fighter and listening to all the different tunes. And so I don't know why, I've just always been dialed into music. And then, I mean, sort of, I was grabbed by a number of albums from a young age. But it's all sort of things that you hear in the car, you know, when you're sitting in the back and you're being driven around. So a lot of that was my parents' music. So there's all sorts in there. Beatles, Bob Dylan, Neil Young, that sort of stuff. As I got a bit older, we had a piano in the house. So I'd always go to the piano and just sort of figure stuff out. And then I'd start having piano lessons when I got a bit older. And then I came across Ben Folds 5. So I was in my mid-teens, sort of 15-ish. And I was introduced to the album Whatever and Ever Amen. And this is, you know, mid-90s or mid to late 90s. And everyone's into grunge or gangster rap. And I could appreciate it, but nothing resonated with me as a sort of nerdy, music-obsessed, piano-playing kid. And then here's this three-piece with an insane piano player as their kind of front man and very clever songwriting as well. And Robert Sledge on bass and Dan and Jesse on drums were fantastic as well. So, yeah, I really went in hard for that. And then sort of that switched me on more confidently to like, oh, this piano thing isn't this sort of weird niche thing from the past. Like it can be contemporary. And that sort of spurred me on to write more of my own music in my teens, which of course is all just full of teenage angst and is utter rubbish, and none of it would gets left on the cutting room floor, I should say. But yeah, that just sort of sent me down a path of open-mindedness, I guess, and discovery, which leads you in all different directions really, I guess. So definitely Whatever and Never Amen was an album that had a deeply profound impact on me. But man, I could talk for hours about the albums that have had profound impacts, you know.
Well, that's a good one because, you know, as I call myself a very weird film fan, sometimes I'll see something and I'll make a correlation to something that has absolutely nothing to do with it. So I'm going to do that now. Mm-hmm. And people, you're just going to, I'm going to blow your mind. Ben Folds did the music to DreamWorks animation Over the Hedge. Yes.
Yeah. Yes, he did.
There, they named a hedge. They didn't know what the hedge was.
Shh, it's okay. It's just a, what is this thing, Lou?
Well, it's Vern.
Well, it's obviously some kind of bush.
I would be a lot less afraid of it if I just knew what it was called.
Let's call it Steve.
Steve?
It's a pretty name.
Steve sounds nice.
Yeah, I'm a lot less scared of Steve.
Oh, great and powerful Steve! What do you want?
So now I'm talking to you, Steve, about that, who was inspired by Ben Folds. What a great album. What that, a great... And,
yeah.
That's funny.
That's brilliant.
Well, tell me about, I'm glad you picked up on that. Otherwise, this would have been a very one-sided conversation. So taking piano lessons, but also trying to like chart your own course, at what point did the piano lessons fall off to where you felt like you were finding you and not necessarily classically learning things or just, you know, doing what everyone else had done?
Well, when I was very little, maybe sort of 7 years old or so, I had piano lessons with a chap who was very much the sort of, you know, sit up straight, hold your wrists like that. These dots mean these notes, now play that. And I couldn't connect with that at all. I maybe did that for 6 or 8 months. And then it reached a point where he basically said to my parents that there's no point. He's not interested in learning the piano. I was like, yeah, okay. And then it was when I was about 12 or 13, you know, because I'd always keep going to the piano and picking out things I'd hear on TV or radio or whatever. And we found a different teacher who was a really chilled out jazzer. You know, sort of, I'd say he was probably in his early 60s at the time and very much had cut his teeth playing on the jazz circuit in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And he was so laid back and just like, well, what do you want to play? Okay, I'll teach you. Because he's the kind of guy who could just hear a song and instantly just shred and play it and have no problem doing that. And so I'd give him, you know, like mixtape, like, you know, compilation tapes that I'd make myself of songs I liked. And I'd be like, I want to play that. I want to play this. I want to play that. And he very cleverly, just through me playing what I wanted to play, he would sneak in the theory about music. And again, being an angsty, rebellious teenager, you know, you don't need the theory, man. That's going to like cramp my creativity. But no, that's nonsense. Because the more you know, the more you know. You know, knowledge is power. And it was great. And it reached that point where even though I was learning to play Beatles songs or Stevie Wonder songs or whatever it might be, he was teaching me so much about scales and harmony and improvisation and just got me to a point where I was then flipping it around and going, right, teach me all the scales, teach me everything. You know, I want to learn theory in a big way. And honestly, when I left home to go to university and had to, that's when I had to stop having piano lessons because I was moving 200 miles away. You know, I'd still have lessons with him to this day if I could. But like you say, it was never that classical route. That sort of more formulaic teaching style just wasn't for me. I think I was a bit too rebellious, I don't know quite what the word is, but I had to do it my way, if that makes sense. So yeah. I'd still have lessons today if I could.
Well, you know, I really do appreciate you telling us all that because what it comes down to is that, yeah, if you've got something in you that says go left and someone's telling you to go right. Well, you're never going to be who you are. So it's, yeah. I mean, that's great serendipity that you found this teacher who was able to give you like stepping stools, like to where you wanted to go. That's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
Yeah. I was so lucky. Really lucky. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things you talked earlier about maybe hearing things in the car, or things your parents played, just a totally geeky question, but mm-hmm. was Bruce Hornsby maybe an influence?
Yeah, my dad had the album The Way It Is that used to get played. And and then there was that song The Way It Is, which Tupac didn't sample interpolated it. So they replayed it for that record, which was such a monster hit in the 90s, wasn't it? So yeah, definitely. Bruce Hornsby was in the mix with Beatles and Fleetwood Mac and all of that stuff. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is, let me check my notes here. There is a song. Oh yeah. On the, Girls on Bikes, Boys on Boards album, which I wanted to spend 17 hours talking about. There's a little piece in the song, The Girl's Hard to Read. It just sounds like his little piano riffs.
Yeah, that was one where I'd made it, I'd released it, and then someone pointed out that it's really close to a Bruce Hornsby song. And I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I went and listened, I was like, oh. Yeah, it's like, it's actually uncomfortably close. I just hope I don't ever like get an email from a lawyer from Bruce Hornsby to say, oi, you know, where's my money? Because there's parts in that where it's like, oh yeah, gosh, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, we've seen it a few times lately where people do stuff and then you know, a famous person does something and then someone nobody's heard of comes out and says, you copied me, and they take them to court. And there were only so many notes, there were only so many chords, and when you've listened to tens of thousands of pieces of music, stuff will work its way into the subconscious sometimes and then unintentionally come out and sound a lot like something else. But yeah, but I mean, man, Bruce Hornsby, like, what a player, what a songwriter. He's great.
Well, great. Well, Steve, tell us about the reason I, like I said, I found your work on Bandcamp, which I'm like, when I was in college, a friend of mine taught me how to play guitar. And I said two very simple things. I said, I want to learn how to play Tequila, and I want to play the riff from Top Gun. Mm-hmm. I learned it in an afternoon. Mm-hmm. I tabbed Top Gun, and I played bar chords to Tequila. I was like, okay, what's next? So I love that Bandcamp is like a lot like that. It's easy to get something, but then as my friend taught me more, he goes, well, once I teach you one chord and then you can do it on bar chords, you see how the progression can go faster and these artists can play. Like, I was doing chords trying to do like Jim Croce or something. And I was like, how can I, it's so slow. And he goes, do it bar. And it's like, boop, boop, boop. And I go, and he blew my mind because I was like, you see how deep the rabbit hole goes. Same thing for Bandcamp. You find Lamatos, you find DAD, you find Opus Science Collective, you find Highway Superstar, all these things. Is like, I love it. So how did you get into that mix? And what was it like in, say, 2014 when you first put out your first album, Rain Driver?
Oh, man. Like, I was sort of, I don't know, fumbling my way through. Like, I didn't really know what I was doing at that time. I knew Bandcamp existed. I knew it was a place you could put something for sale. And it was by far the simplest and easiest and most accessible platform for a completely independent newbie with no understanding or knowledge of it to do. You know, at that time, getting tracks onto like iTunes still felt like a bit of a difficult and complicated thing. And yeah, so I didn't really know what I was doing, and I was just making it up as I went along. And over time, you know, and at that point, like, I didn't understand how really like hashtagging worked or any of this. Like, I was completely in the dark on it all. And I just sort of, through far too much time spent trawling Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and forums and whatnot, just sort of slowly made sense of it all and started to understand that, if you tag things in certain ways because they sound like certain things, they get entered into, you know, they show up when people search for these things and that things. And, you know, and all my sort of very early stuff is still very sort of explorational. There we go. It's, you know, there's a lot of exploring going on. I'm trying to find my feet, figure out what I'm doing with music. I started doing this sort of, you know, I graduated from uni and then I basically spent 8 or 9 years kind of trying to be an adult and live a normal life, and sort of not being as proactive as I should have been in terms of making my own music. And so I started, and yeah, the early stuff's quite ropey. Production value's not very good. And the whole, like, how to market things and promote things and build a fan base was very rough. And I think, knowing what I know now, if I was to start all over, you know, it would be a completely different story. I would have a consistent and sort of cohesive brand image, as it were, that's in finger air quotes, brand image with like the same imagery across all sorts of things, and everything would look like professional and neat and tidy. But man, yeah, at the beginning, I had no idea. I was just making it up as I went along and hoping for the best.
Well, don't get too down on yourself. If you ever saw the very first Apple logo, it's very heady and intellectual, but it is beyond complicated in the world of a Nike swoosh or McDonald's arches. Yeah. And little by little, they peeled it away to have the literal bite out of the peel. So it's okay. But, you know, there's something brilliant about Rain Driver. There's some real driving melodies. And I like listening to it. The one thing I really want to ask you is there's a... you've got this, if I call it a squeal, it sounds terrible, but there's this like squeal sound in the last half of the second to last track, Ugatu Returns for Ame.
Right.
And it's just like, it kind of becomes your calling card in a way, like the energy that you put into your tracks and the fun. So I guess maybe let's start with that. Was it your goal to just do fun electronic stuff once you gravitated from piano? Like, how'd you find this this pathway to OSC?
Well, so I'd say the electronic side of things, like when I first went to university, I knew nothing about electronic music whatsoever. I'd listened to it, but I didn't know the first thing about how synths worked or how to make electronic music. I learned that at university. And I'd often like tinker and play and dabble with software synthesizers through my 20s. And then when I sort of decided I need to start having some sort of creative outlet, otherwise I'm going to go mad. Really, the only feasible way I had to do that at that time was synthesizers. Recording pianos is a bit of a cumbersome nightmare. And at that point in my life, I didn't even have... a digital or an acoustic piano in my flat, so it was very much a case of sort of I just had to use the tools at my disposal, which were the software synthesizers that came with the music production software I was using, which is called Logic Pro, and I just out of necessity I used them, and I've always kind of believed that it's not so much about the equipment you use as how you use it. Nothing I have is overly like flashy or cutting edge. I've got equipment here that's from like the 80s and the early 90s, and it's by modern and even by the 80s standards, they weren't the best things you could get. They're quite sort of average at best. But if you really learn how to use them, you can get the most out of them. So, I mean, yeah, it wasn't so much graduating just as a necessity. And I guess when you make music that's using electronic instruments, it tends to have a certain aesthetic. And so you tend to appeal to a certain audience. And so you just sort of naturally steer yourself that way, I think. I guess, I don't know if that answers. Oh, sorry, I remember the question. and was it ever my intention to have a particular... No, I'm afraid not. I'm quite maybe not fickle's not the right word, but yeah, I just let myself follow my whims. If I feel like making music in a certain style, I'll have a go at it, and if I think it's good enough, I'll stick it out. So you know, that's why if you look at my Bandcamp, you'll see synthwave, you'll see stuff that's more like electro funk, you'll see stuff that's like 80s Japanese city pop. You'll see ambient stuff. I recently dabbled in a bit of lo-fi. Like, yeah, it's a little bit of a broad spectrum, because I think I'd probably get a bit bored just doing the same thing all the time. I like to challenge myself, and it's learning through doing, kinesthetic learning, learning through doing. If I want to learn about lo-fi music, I'm going to learn about it by making it. And yeah, it's that sort of thing.
Well, no, I think that's great. You know, there's the expression jack of all trades and master of none. But I think when it comes to music, I don't think that you can ever learn enough about something. I think it's always going to be interpreted through you. I remember speaking to Patrick Doyle, and we were doing one of his scores had a very French sensibility to it. And I said, well, Patrick, how do you make it sound French? How do you, you know, do you study the modalities? Do you study school like French? And what he just told me very simply, he goes, it's my interpretation. So, and this is totally paraphrasing, or I'm making this up, but it's like, if French music had a 4-beat rhythm, he might throw in 5, because to him that sounded French to him. So there's really no rules, but you know, as long as, like you said, you're trying to find something that works for you. And I think I applaud any artist for not sticking to something that feels routine, because you flex your muscles and you do stuff so you don't get bored. I think that's brilliant. So, well, tell me in your mind, your perception, what is the difference between vaporwave and synthwave?
Oh, okay. Actually, that's not too tricky a question. So synthwave is looking to, I'm sure there are a lot of hardcore synthwave people who might object to my definition of it, but you're looking to that sort of 80s kind of science fiction aesthetic that then has some tropes from 80s film and pop culture. I'd say synthwave as a genre it's like if you take the music of 80s science fiction films and maybe action films as well, and you kind of couple that with elements of 90s French house, and so it can take a number of forms. So my sort of, for me, the synthwave overlord, the one who is the best of the best, is Mitch Murder. And when you listen to his stuff, it's clean, it's polished, it's more 80s than the 80s. It's phenomenal. But then some synthwave gets really heavy and really dark and really, really angry and fast. And that actually feels, to me, it feels like it's got more in common with sort of late 90s, early 2000s, like techno and house music. So it very much lives in that sort of firmly electronic dance music kind of paradigm, in my mind at least. Like I say, I'm sure there are lots of synthwave buffs who are more versed on the genre details than me. And so in terms of my own forays into synthwave, I've always kind of stayed on the fringes, feeling more like the way I like it. A lot of synthwave is like Escape from New York, the movie, you know, dark, sinister, you know, loads of overtones of like threat and dread. My synthwave is like Pretty in Pink. You know, it's like a John Hughes film. It's, you know, it's a teen romance rom-com thing that's got 80s pop cultural references, but it's much more lighthearted. And then vaporwave on the other extreme, I think for some people it's all kind of tied up in, there's a sort of political undercurrent of anti-consumerism, and they take, which is why they're taking stuff that is deemed to be like older, like an old consumable product from the past, mass produced things. So they're taking cheesy pop, if you like, even if the source material is brilliant, which a lot of it really is, they're taking this cheesy mass produced pop, and they're distorting it and contorting it and turning it into something that's much calmer and low fidelity and serves much more almost like ambient music, because you can just put it on and let it be, as Brian Eno says, as ignorable as it is interesting. And so you can let that kind of wash over you, and it has a vibe and it has a mood. I think sonically, it's a lot dirtier and slower and muddier than synthwave. And then there's all this other stuff culturally that goes with it, such as this kind of anti-consumerism. But I could be completely wrong, and the vaporwave fanboys might come after me for that definition. So, you know, from where I'm sitting, that's what it seems like.
That's okay. And you know what? Everybody's got an opinion, just like everybody has eyeballs, and what works for you doesn't have to work for everybody else. That's what is great about consumerism and stuff. But, you know, here's something funny you mentioned about Escape from New York. I've always found it hysterical to the point of crying. Whenever I hear somebody try to do, and I'm not going to name names, even though they're really good at what they do, a lot of times they try to do John Carpenter. And I just feel like there are so many, like, it's so close to John Carpenter. I think as good as it is, I'm like, why am I listening to you if you're just doing the same thing that he's doing? It's like,
exactly.
So what I love about the synthwave is that there's an energy to it. And it really doesn't, to me, having lived through the 80s, it reminds me of the 80s, but I don't feel like I've ever heard that before, which makes it's fresh. And, you know, I don't know if it's a tempo or the, like, whatever it is, but I love it. So I want to show you this. Like I said, I'm a consumer.
Oh, yes.
This is the Girls on Bikes, Boys on Boards. Two EPs put together to make one, and the fans can't see this, but I put it on my Twitter like a year ago. It's played nonstop on my Bandcamp app, on my record player at home.
Awesome.
Mr. Opus Science Collective, tell us, where did that name come from? What's it mean to you?
Okay, so when I decided I was going to release music, I knew I wanted to put it out under a three-letter abbreviation. I was listening to a lot of the Yellow Magic Orchestra at the time. The Yellow Magic Orchestra abbreviates to YMO. And I was thinking, I need a three-letter abbreviation that's quick and easy. You know, you're not gonna no W's in there. It's got to be nice and quick. You know, three syllables. I went for OSC because OSC is actually the abbreviation for oscillator, which is the component on a synthesizer where sound begins. So on a synthesizer, the first piece of the puzzle is the oscillator that generates the current, that generates the wave in the shape of, you know, that gets turned into a sound wave. And that is always abbreviated to OSC on synthesizers. So I thought, well, I'm working with electronic music. I'm working with synthesizers, and therefore the sound starting with oscillators with OSC. So I'm just going to call myself that. However, it was a bit more convoluted because the original plan was that it would be a collective. I had several people I was working with, and friends and colleagues, former colleagues, etc., that I had this grand vision that we will all have, basically, we'd all have our own projects and we would randomly collaborate. Because at the time there was lots of talk of collaborations, and this would be an umbrella project through which to put our random collaborations out. So let's say there's five or six of us. If one or two of us got together and did a thing, we'd stick it out under OSC. If two of the other people got together and did a thing, or three people got, just we'll all put it out under OSC. And then the grand plan eventually would be that, you know, if you went to do that live, you'd go to an OSC live show, but you'd see like five or six different people come and do things. You know, more like a label in some respects. That all just kind of fell by the wayside because, you know, we were all of an age where all of a sudden jobs got very real. Partners started getting pregnant. You know, life happens, right? It just became almost instantly, as soon as we'd had the idea and started setting up Facebook accounts and Twitter accounts and all the rest, like, it all fell apart again. So it was like, well, I've got the admin on all of this. I'm just going to keep using it and just keep sticking it out under the name, which is why actually over time I've migrated away from calling it Opus Science Collective and just calling it OSC. But it's also a fantastic thing to Google because nobody else is using those three words together. That was another thing I thought, I've got to put three words together that nobody's going to be using because it makes no sense or whatever, you know. So yeah, you're not going to land on the wrong thing if you search Opus Science Collective, you know. That's
got locked down. Steve's got it locked down.
Yeah.
That's great. And you know, things may change, like you said. Your friends found jobs and their partners got pregnant, but you know what, you have the umbrella, so to speak. You got the digital umbrella, you got the copyright, the logistics, so one day if you build it, people will come. So yeah, know, I have faith in you. I have faith. Well, let's just run through it, because I mean, we are, let's see, today is May the 13th, which means we are probably I'll say 5 weeks from summer. I have to say that this is the ultimate summer album. That was my, I'm Ridge Racer 4, everybody. If you find me on Bandcamp, I have a lot of OSC things in my collection. And I commented that this is the ultimate summer album. And you can listen to it any time of year. What was really attractive to me, aside from the music, which stands for itself, is we live in an era where we're gravitating back to physical things. I don't think the pandemic had anything to do with it, but it certainly kept us apart enough that we want to touch and feel and travel and stuff. So, Steve, what is your take on vinyl? This is a beautiful vinyl produced by Sofa King Vinyl. How involved were you in it? Whose idea was it? And do you love it like I do?
Yeah, I do. I keep all my vinyl, just obviously your listeners can't see, but this is all like literally my vinyl, as in my releases on vinyl and cassette and whatnot are all stashed here, because yeah, I love it. I think it, you know, it's, if you told 21-year-old me that, you know, by the time you're 35 you're gonna have multiple releases on vinyl, I'd have ripped your right arm off. Like it is a wonderful thing, even though, like, in the grand scheme of music releasing, they're very limited run. It's still a great thing to have, and I go around my parents' house, and they're proud enough that as you walk up the stairs in their house, there's girls on bikes and boys on boards in picture frames, like unopened, you know, which is, it's a very nice thing, you know. So I love it. It's really cool. And as for Sofa King, they were the first label I released any vinyl with. They approached me after I released Girls on Bikes, and they, you know. Max, the chap who kind of runs that, said, really love what you're doing with that, and reckoned that we could do a vinyl release. And I was like, yeah, I thought, nah, this can't be real, this guy's pulling my leg, sort of thing. And but no, it just went from there. And yeah, we worked really closely. You know, we'd have a very busy chat on Facebook Messenger, always back and forth in things, and we worked very much on the artwork sort of together, in that, like, we already had the artwork, but just rejigging it and getting it right for the template of the cover was actually quite a lot of work. And you know, I've dabbled a little bit in Photoshop, just as needs must, sort of thing. And so, you know, we spent a long time going back and forth, just tweaking, getting like the cassette tapes right as well, because we did cassettes as well. And we did a release of Girls on Bikes, and it kind of did better than expected. And then we did Boys on Boards, and that did better than expected. And so we stuck them both together, because I've always wanted them. Although there's like 2 years between them, I've always thought of them as a side A and a side B to the same thing. You know, they are an entity in of themselves. They're essentially an album that's been divided in half and released at two different points in time. Girls is side A, Boys is side B. So yeah, it's just a lot of fun working with Max and getting everything just right to put out. And he's an audiophile as well. That's what's nice about. So anything you get from Sofa King Vinyl, you know you're getting really good quality, because basically Max is a massive nerd about sound and sound quality and pressing and weights and like, you know, getting it specially mastered. And I love that, you know, because I'm equally as much a nerd about sound as well. So it's really nice to have that kind of kindred spirit that you can work with on a release like that. And it's very rewarding. I don't have any sort of conflicted feelings about consumerism in that regard. I mean, if I was selling like thousands of CDs, which are so plastic, and I might have a little bit more reservation, but I mean, in the grand calculus, it's fine.
Well, I love the vision you have from trying to create a canopy, a circus for all your friends to come and play music with you, to the side A and side B. I mean, that takes some master planning in my mind, you know, just the vision. But then you also have to now fill that track list with things. So, Steve, do you want to break down some of your favorite tracks? I have mine and plenty of questions, but what speaks to you? What was the most sensitive and special in your heart? And what do you love about that album or both of the albums?
It's a trick. I guess my favorite track from Girls on Bikes is The Ride Home, That was one where I'd got the other four tracks completely finished. And then I'd got this other thing that I was kind of tacking on the end, which was literally sort of a 90-second little jam that then fizzled out. And it's nice in of itself, but it wasn't doing it for me. It wasn't sealing it off. And it had some silly name like... the scoreboard or something, I can't remember, like, because it sounded like something you'd hear when you're watching the sports in the 80s and you'd see, like, they put the scoreboard up at the end of a game for like 30 seconds while the commentators are chatting and there's some weird little groovy music in the background. It was a bit like that. It was a bit of a throwaway thing, it just wasn't sticking, but the rest of it was done. Like that, I considered the project finished. I'd already commissioned the artwork from Mizucat and everything was like in the production pipeline. And then I think it was almost like one evening I sat down and just started playing a bit and ended up kind of almost just noodling around, improvising stuff. And yeah, just got that da-da-da-da-da-da, and I was like, oh, there's something in that. And I just really quickly threw it together in like 2 hours. I sent it to a mate and he sort of said, you know, I think this is actually quite strong. What do you think of this? And he suggested, he's called 24/7, by the way. He makes some cool synthwave. He's got two albums out worth checking out. You know, at the end when it's kind of fading out and there's that da 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 kind of thing, that was nested in the middle somewhere, and he suggested flipping that and sticking that at the end and having everything fade out into that as it kind of went off in the distance. And so the next evening after work, I got in and made those changes and, you know, kind of tidied the mix up a bit, and that tune was literally sort of bish bash bosh done. And I think with that, just between the melody and some of the tonalities I managed to get out of the synth on that, I slightly captured Lightning in a Bottle, because that's the one that seems to lure people in the most as well, like on Spotify and stuff. So yeah, that's probably my sort of personal favorite from that. Yeah. And then Boys on Boards, James's Mum, that's probably the one on Boys on Boards that I like. On the grounds that, that actually came about from a very interesting interaction I had with a guy called James, who emailed me one day. He said, I see you do requests. If I give you some information about my mother, can you make a piece of music about her? And I thought he was winding me up. So I indulged it. I humoured him, thinking it was a prank. Because like I work in education, so I thought, I don't tell my students what I do for, like, you know, obvious reasons, because they'll just troll me otherwise. But I thought one of them had figured me out and was trolling me. So I humoured it. But the longer this went on, the more I realised this was a genuine request. And then it reached a point where I sort of said, well, look, if I'm to make a bespoke piece of music, it's going to probably take X amount of time. And if I'm doing that, I've got to kind of charge X amount of money. And at which point he was like, oh, I didn't realize that it would cost money. And it's like, you know, I was being as nice as I could with the guy. Like, and we left it at, I said, how about this? If I ever make a piece of music that I think's befitting of our conversation, I'm going to call it James's mum. And he was like, okay, that's cool. Love it. And then, you know, a year or so went by. And at this point, I'm mentally plotting out Boys on Boards. And I wanted every track on Boys on Boards to be a response to its respective song on Girls on Bikes. So you've got Girls on Bikes, Boys on Boards, Boys Fall Easy, The Girl's Hard to Read. I've forgotten what the rest are. Oh, yeah. Cycles at Sundown and Skate Parks at Sunset. You know what I mean? There's that parallel. And then we've got Lipsticks and Lollipops, which is kind of the sassy one on Girls on Bikes. And I thought, right, we need something equally sassy, but from the boys' perspectives. And I'm thinking, what the teenage boys, no matter what, where you are in the world, where you grew up, any group of boys, they always had one friend who kind of had a hot mum. Like, and that's the thing, isn't it, right? And what's more is she kind of knew it. And that's why I got that audio sample that goes, hello, boys, at the start of the track. Sorry, my cat's talking to me. You've got that hello, boys sample at the start of the track. And then from there, and then after I'd released that, I actually got an email from this guy, James, to just say, love the tune, played it to my mum. She thought it was brilliant. So it's just like mission accomplished. So, yeah, that's.
Oh, geez. You know, I couldn't have asked for a better response because my favorite is The Ride Home. And I don't know if it's just there's some chemistry alchemy happening. Because when I listen to it, I get the vibe of the song. But then when you call it The Ride Home, I could just imagine myself like I just came home from a date with a, you know, girl for like I'm riding my bike back in ninth grade all over again. It's like that captures the feel of like, holy shit, Steve did it. Where do the sound effects come in? There's like my favorite one is Girls on Bikes. Somebody drops a wrench, like they're working on a bike. And so like, and then in Lipsticks and Lollipops, like somebody's breathing. So how do you ask somebody to breathe on a dance track for you? Like, what are these sound like? Tell us all about that stuff.
Well, not wanting to shatter the illusion too much, but if I told you it was my breathing just pitched up to sound a bit more effeminate, yeah.
All right, this interview is over. We're not friends anymore.
So yeah, I know because it's quite, and I sort of take a bit of inspiration from looking out for Big Love by Fleetwood Mac. It's got that, you know, it's the early 80s. Akai have invented samplers and Fleetwood Mac are playing with a sampler and they sample Christy McVie. I know everyone wants to think it's Stevie Nicks, but it's Christy McVie giving that quite passionate sounding like, sound. And they've got it on the sampler and they're just playing it like, And then they got the guy doing his and it's quite charged. And Fleetwood Mac are regularly on rotation anyway, so I sort of thought, right, I've got to capture a little bit of that, and what's the quickest and easiest way to do that is to record myself and then literally using production tools, you pitch it up a bit to make it go higher so it sounds more effeminate, and bingo. Yeah. all the bike tools, like the dropping of the tools and whatnot, that is... one of the plugins I use for my drum programming is called Battery, and that's by a company called Native Instruments. And just one of their presets, I think it's called something like the garage or the workshop or something. And rather than being actual drum sounds, it's just a whole load of like noises of like spanners being dropped and things like that. So that was a bit of a chance thing. I happened to open that up one day and hear it and think, oh, that's cool. I should use that when I finally get... Because for a long time, I had in mind to make a project called Girls on Bikes. And I just thought to myself, yeah, that's something for that day. Made a mental note and just, you know, months later came back to it. So again, it's that whole principle I talked about before of just... knowing your equipment, what you've got. You don't have to get the latest thing or the greatest thing. Just learn inside out what you've got and how you can maximize that for what you want to create.
Well, you know, take that, Song Exploder, because that is just brilliant. And, you know, trust me, you didn't ruin any mysticism. I just love the mindset and using the tools. Because, I mean, I think about it, this is not putting them down in the least, but look at Blue Man Group. If you think about, like, physically what they're doing, they're playing with PVC and hollow instruments, but they're a Vegas phenomenon. So, it is what it is. As long as you've got the talent and the drive, which clearly you do. And that's why we're here talking about it. So let's see, a couple more things I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. So do you know what a Wurlitzer is?
I do. It's one of my, as in a Wurlitzer, well, I know the company. And when you say Wurlitzer to me, my instant go-to is the A200 electric piano. That's one of my dream kind of things to own one day, yeah.
Well, there's a portion of Lipstick and Lollipops about the 2 minute mark where you just like jam. And I know it has the impression of a Wurlitzer, but it may not have been. But like, I love how it, you know, when you get a dance track or get something, it's like, and it doesn't really build. What I love about the music is that it builds and it goes on a journey. So I wanted to ask you more about that. Like when you're able to go on these riffs in a song.
Oh yeah, I mean that's if you know, looping back to my piano teacher from my teens, he was a jazzer, and he got me really into blues and jazz, and that's just there. It, you know, I know my scales. I'm well versed in improvising. I spent a long time playing in function bands, doing covers at like corporate gigs and weddings. And someone gives you 16 bars in a key, off you go, make it up as you go along. And yeah, those sorts of solos, which I like to pepper into a lot of what I do, because like you say, so much dance music does, or electronic music generally, can borderline on getting a touch repetitive, which is kind of its thing. Like, that's not a critique, that's just what it does. But for me, I get a little bit bored with that, and I'm just like, yeah, I don't just want to play this. I'm going to shred. I'm going to have a little solo and play around a bit. And you take the initial melodies and then you embellish them, and then you really go off on one. And you'll hear on nearly, I think on nearly all of the tracks on both Girls and Boys, that there's a spot somewhere where I have a little bit of improvisational play. I think that's just my blues jazz background coming out, I think.
Well, can you tell us about the production of it? Because when it becomes electronic, this is going to sound like the dumbest question ever, but do you have to play it all at once? Can you do like a song start and then fill in with some improvisation and weave them together?
Oh yeah, totally. You can put it together like Lego. You really can, note by note if necessary. So the way I normally go about things, or certainly in those instances, you start with one thing. Consider that like you're setting your Christmas tree, and then you start adding the decorations. So it might be the drum beat with the bass. It might just be a chord progression, which I might just put a four to the floor kick drum or a hi-hat on every beat, almost just like a metronome, just so I got the tempo and I play some chords in. It might be that like you come up with the chords or the rhythm and bass for a verse or a chorus, and you just develop that section up in its entirety, and then think, right, I need to go somewhere else now, and then move on to the next bit. By the time we get to the solos, normally the last things to go in, those like flashy moments, because by that point, you, in your own mind, you've got a vision of what the end product's got to feel like. Then you find a sound, like a synth sound, or in the case of Lipstick and Lollipops, that's kind of a Yamaha DX electric piano sound, which is done with my DX21, which is like a poor man's DX7. You get the sound you want, and then you just kind of, you put that section on and you play it through a couple of times and you record a couple of bits. And it might be that I sort of get the solo pretty much exactly how I want it first take. Sometimes it's two or three or four takes. Sometimes they're spliced together, like the first half of a take is good and the second half of a different take is good, and you stick them together. It is honestly like Lego. You just build it up in bit by bit by bit.
That's brilliant. And like to my ears, I wouldn't know. And so I think that that's very helpful to understand. Well, I think, Steve, why don't we round this interview out with some of your covers, because you've gone from original work to, and not chronologically speaking, but you've just done a lot of work. So seems like you're a Ghostbusters fan. Seems like you're a Lupin the Third fan. Why don't we, I'm going to throw it to you. What do you want to speak about first, Lupin or the Ghostbusters?
Ghostbusters has the risk of going on for very long, but let's talk Lupin. We'll go Lupin the Third first. Yeah, go on.
I own a Yuji Ono jazz trio of Lupin, and then I own the very first soundtrack from the TV show, and it's great going between the two because one is, you know, cartoons and it's the songs, but then it's the jazz, and it's just like so many different interpretations. So what drew you to want to do a cover, and how did you make it your own?
Oh, right. Well, firstly, big Lupin fan. My partner's Japanese, so we've got like the direct connection to, like, her sister can send over Blu-rays and whatever that they can get no problem. So yeah, big fan of Lupin. He gets watched a lot in the house, and you know, we have the family playlist in the car, for which has a bit of music that we can all agree on, me, her, and the boy. And you know, a lot of film and cartoon music finds its way into that, Lupin being one of that. And I love Yuji Ono. What a legend, what an absolute boss. You've got all of his different like incarnations of the theme, because he's always the one doing the arrangements and coming up with all the different versions. So there's like, I think there's a 78, a 79 and a 1980 version, and they go from the sort of the kind of more traditional Lupin that we know through to a sort of disco-y one where the leads played on a really nice kind of like sleazy synth, through to a sort of like really jazzy one where the main theme's played on marimbas, and it's wonderful. And I don't even know. I think one day I was probably just playing it out just for leisure's sake. And I suddenly thought, you know what, a sort of synth wavy version of this might be fun. Because you can, thinking about the sort of that kind of xylophone marimbery type sound that's on the 1981, I thought, well, I could use that kind of default Yamaha DX 80s sounding xylophone up the top, and then I could kind of do a similar thing with the synth lead that what happens on the 1979 Lupin arrangement. And yeah, I think it was just one of those. That's the sort of thing that I'll probably knock out in like a day. Like it'll be a quiet, a rainy Saturday, and I'll just sort of sit down and go, oh yeah, da 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 da, you know, and just play Lupin because it's something to do, you know. And then, so yeah, then there's Ghostbusters.
Okay, well I'm going to tease it up for you. So we got Chaim Saban and Shuki Levy, who, you know, there is a very small but passionate love of the real Ghostbusters music from the cartoon show. And I don't know why, whether it's like the mystery theme or the sorrow theme or like, hey, we won and it's time to have a relax. Like there's so many great things about it. And it's so great that it lives autonomously from what Elmer Bernstein and the sequel had. So, you know, like what is important to you about that music?
It was the biggest thing in my childhood. You know, I had the toys, I obsessed over the films, I obsessed over the cartoons, I still do, to be honest. You can't quite see it on the camera, I've got a little Stay Puft, an Ecto one up there. It's I mean, you know, hashtag Ghostbusters is life. It just something about it just grabbed me as a child and never went away ever. You know, like Harold Ramis's death was the first celebrity death that ever actually made me cry. It was like, they're just a huge and enormous part of my life. And then completely like coincidentally, someone who was looking to start a YouTube channel dedicated to Ghostbusters content wrote to me. They'd heard some of my other music and they wrote to me and they said, I'm thinking of launching a Ghostbusters YouTube channel. about like the fandom of Ghostbusters, and would you be interested in making a few pieces of music that are suitable, that feel Ghostbusters-y? I was like, dude, you have no idea who you've just asked. Like, this is insane. Like, now his thing never came to be. I was so hyped for it as a commission that I was like, mate, I'll just make it for just as long as you tell people I made the music, I don't even need paying. Just, you know, I just want to do this. This, I've instantly got 1,001 ideas. So, yeah, I mean, and if you look through the track titles, you can see that I'm drawing from the films thematically and kind of in the order that things are going. But musically, I'm kind of drawing a strange middle ground between, or triangulating rather, the cartoon music, the film music, and then just kind of funky electro stuff, and sort of trying to meet somewhere in the middle. And there's some things. So, for example, there's I forget which one it is now. I think it's That's a Big Twinkie, which is off the second, the volume two. That's kind of my, I think it's like, yes, that's my ode to Winston, right? And the thing that I love, right, in the original Ghostbusters film, Winston and Ray have that wonderful conversation in the car where he's like, Ray, has it not occurred to you the reason we've been so busy lately is the dead have been rising from the grave? And then he goes, how about some music? And then they press play, and now that piece of music that plays is like a tiny little 16 bar thing in Elmer Bernstein's original score. It's not, because it's so different, it's like a pop tune, you just assume they licensed a random piece of pop music for that, but it's actually in the score. And then it cuts to that long shot of Ecto going across the bridge, and it's like, whew, one of the finest shots in cinematic history. But anyway, and that little 16 bar jam by Elmer Bernstein is funky as it's got this wicked tam tam feel that leads in. Yeah, and so I was like, yeah, I gotta do basically the same thing, but just be different enough that I don't get sued. Not that anyone would sue little old me, but do you know what I mean? And so there's that sort of a thing. And then there's the one for the actual fire station, for the Hook and Ladder 8, that's which is 14 North Moore Street. That's the actual address of, in real life, of where the fire station is in real life. Now, that piece of music is, again, it's another one where I've looked at what was in the cartoon, and there's a playlist on YouTube of loads of the cartoon's original music where people have like used processing to try and extrapolate the dialogue and isolate just the bits with the music. And it's like really close, and I look to mimic the sound palette because, you know, a lot of those cartoon soundtracks were made using like very cheap and crude, even for the time, because everything's done on such tight budgets that they'd have had just like a real basic general MIDI synth unit that they were sequencing with. And so I thankfully I have some really cheap rubbish general MIDI type synth stuff, so I was able to kind of get close and get a very similar vibe going on there, and just make something that when people hear it, they're like, yeah, that kind of feels like the original Ghostbusters cartoon. And then there's some other spots where I just really indulged myself and went for it. And I got the sample pack. Someone had managed to pull all the sound effects from the video game, like the PlayStation Xbox video game, the fairly recent one from 2013 or whenever it was. I still sort of consider it a Ghostbusters 3, and then Afterlife could be a Ghostbusters 4 to that. But anyway, that's another conversation. Yeah, and so someone had pulled all the sound effects from that game. So you've got proton packs, you'd got PKE meters, the traps, Slimer, some big menacing groans from Stay Puft, and of course, Ecto-1. And so, you know, this is like, great, what a wonderful set of ingredients here. So, there's one tune where I actually caught sort of, I managed to get that kind of, the proton pack firing up there. noise, you know, and I managed to kind of play with the kind of the bounce and the rhythm of that tone and how it kind of starts in one place and then raises up, and there's that really high pitched noise that comes through, and yet there's also that thunderous bass, and I'm able to play with that and use that rhythmically and kind of, and if you listen to it on headphones, I think you'll hear things coming from different, I can't remember exactly, but I think I put things in different sides so that it feels like the kind of, they're catching a ghost while the piece of music's playing. So it's like action pack, you know, nerdiness dialed up to 11. I just, you know, yeah. As soon as the guy wrote to me about that, I bit his hand off. I made what became the real OSC Volume 1. And then it just coincided that I finished it shortly before Halloween. So it's like, right, this is a Halloween drop. And then about 6 weeks before Halloween the next year, I was like, I should put out something for Halloween because that seems to be what everyone does. And I was like, I need an OSC Volume 2. And I was like, oh man, that's like 6 weeks away, right? Ah, here we go. And so for like a month, I just like binged making Ghostbusters stuff every day. It's just such fun to play around, because it's that, it's a kitsch nostalgic sound palette that I'm playing with. So it's just steeped in nostalgia, and it's a topic that is deeply nostalgic. So it's almost like therapy and coping with getting old. You know, it's like you get to turn to the things you loved as a child and still play with them, just in a slightly more grown up way. Yeah, it's cool.
In heart, which is all you need to do.
Yeah, I get accused a lot of basically being a child trapped in an adult's body, which I think is quite a fair summary. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, there's that line in Ocean's 11 where Brad Pitt Brad Pitt and George Clooney are talking. No, they're talking to Carl Reiner, and he goes, no, I've changed. I'm dating a woman who works the unmentionables counter at the mall. And he's like, no, Saul, guys like us don't change. We either stay sharp or we get dull, but we don't change. So, but you know, it's so funny. I'm looking at my comment. I bought the OSC Volume 1. I said, you could just tell OSC had so much fun making this. And so my favorite is the Positron Collider, but on Volume 2, I think it's probably There Is No Zool, Only Dana, because that really draws from Ghostbusters 2. And
It does, yes.
I love actually what Elmer Bernstein did for the first one, but I have a real soft spot for the music in the second one, so much more.
Yeah, it's quite a short score. Again, I think, you know, that in some ways they didn't throw as much money perhaps at the music for that one, but or relied more on like the Bobby Brown big hit to oh my gosh, what a tune. Yeah. Anyway, that nice, because I basically kind of meld the two together, don't I have that kind of the Elmer Bernstein Dana's thing, the da 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 da, and then kind of like round it into dun, 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 you know, that much more late 80s, because I'm doing a brain fart. I've got the soundtrack in my iTunes library. I'm forgetting his name, but it's the same composer he used on that Ivan Reitman used on It's Not a Tumor, Kindergarten Cop. So because Ivan Reitman obviously made Ghostbusters 1 and 2, and then he made Kindergarten Cop and various and Twins and whatnot, but he used that same composer for Ghostbusters 2, and then they almost went straight into making Kindergarten Cop after that. So he took that composer with him, and when you listen to the soundtrack on Kindergarten Cop, you're like, yeah, that's a very Ghostbusters 2 soundtrack. I've forgotten his name.
Look it up right now. Randy Edelman.
Yeah, that's the one. Randy Edelman. Yeah. It's great. It's got all of that kind of glossy, kitsch, tackiness that a lot of late 80s stuff had, which is a bit like what we'd say in this. Do you have Marmite in the States, do you? We have this stuff called Marmite. It's like a yeast-based spread, and you either love it or you hate it. That sound palette is very much, and to this day, like sometimes like I'll show my parents or my older brother or older sister something I made, and I, you know, they're not really, they like music, but they're not musicians, and they kind of look at me sideways like, Why? You know, why does it sound like it's from the 80s? Like, music in the 80s was awful. I'm like, yeah, whatever, shut up, go away. Because, you know, it's Marmite, it's Vegemite. You either love it or you hate it.
I'm going to put that in the post. I'm going to, when I write the, when I publish this, I'll be like, of all the stuff in the exchanges and the brilliant things that Steve talked to me about, that is the best comparison in how you relate, whether you like something or not like something. Well, Steve, you know, I feel like, yes, we could go on and on about this. What I'd love to do is have a follow-up view about the theory that in Ghostbusters 2, they're actually dead. Have you heard about that theory?
Of course.
Okay, let's spend 2 hours talking about that. But Mr. Opus Science Collective, thank you so much for your time. Please, to take us out, tell us where people can find you and get your good stuff.
Oh, well, there's opussciencecollective.com. Which is just the one-stop shop for everything. That will point you to everything you need everywhere, or if you want to get in touch with me. And then otherwise, opussciencecollective.bandcamp.com is my Bandcamp. Otherwise, everywhere else, I think I'm at opussience, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. I've got a TikTok, but I've not posted anything because that seems like there's lots of scary young people on there and I don't understand it. But yeah, at opussience, or just Google opussience collective, you'll find me.
And like you said, you'll be the first one there because no one else has ever put those together.
Exactly.
Well, it is a shame that people can't get their hands on something like this until it's like on Discogs or some third party, but the music is available digitally. Take it with you wherever you go. I do. It's on my phone. So everyone, please check out Steve's stuff.
Yeah. Cheeky little plug. If you liked Girls on Bikes and Boys on Boards, there is something coming in June, which is... the sonically the closest thing to them that I've made since then. It could almost be considered a third in a trilogy.
So, you just blew my mind. A third side to the record.
Thematically, it's not a girls and boys type thing. It's got more of a kind of sports theme. But sonically, musically, it is as close to those as anything I've made. So if you're a fan of Girls on Bikes and Boys on Boards, you're going to hopefully really like what I'm releasing in June. So yeah, follow me on socials to find out more.
Everyone, thank you. And please, thanks Steve for his time, his energy, his wonderful music sensibilities. And we will catch you next time.